Hi, this is Alan Ruff, the Thursday host of A Public Affair. If you have a moment and the resources, remember to support the station. And if you will, head over to WRTFM.org to donate and to see what else is going on at the station. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication. And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Well, as the Senate performances preceding Judge Amy Coney Barrett's ascent to the Supreme Court nears a finale today, I thought it would be of interest to examine some of the behind-the-scenes players, some of the machinations of the power players and dark money, the producers of this show, if you will. How is it that any given individual comes to sit before a panel of U.S. senators as a presidential nominee for the highest court in the land? What influences or interests come into play that shape that selection process? What is that, to use that common Wisconsin phrase, sifting and winnowing process? Who gets to forward a possible contender's name to the president of the United States? With us to explore some of these questions and others is Lisa Graves. Lisa founded True North Research and is its executive director and editor-in-chief. She has spearheaded several major breakthrough investigations into those distorting our democracy and public policy. She has served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice in the Clinton administration. She formerly was Chief Counsel for Nominations for Senator Patrick Leahy on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, and has worked as an adjunct professor at George Washington University Law School, as well as a senior legislative strategist for the ACLU on national security. Lisa's an expert on how special interests have distorted our political policy, and as such, has been a frequent guest on MSNBC, CNN, ABC, NBC, all the major networks, a long, lengthy list. Her op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Times, Slate, and The Hill, and she's also written for The Nation, in these times, The Progressive, Huffington Post, and numerous other national outlets. She's also president of the board of directors of the Madison-based Center for Media and Democracy. Lisa Graves, welcome back to WORT.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's a joy to be on with you and have a conversation with you and to speak with you and the WORT listeners.
Well, Lisa, before we start, of course, we want to get to Judge Barrett and who she is, and then move into some discussion of the forces at play behind her nomination. But before we do that, I'm wondering if you could share some of your general impressions about the hearings this week, the proceedings since the whole thing, Barrett's confirmation, has pretty much been a done deal. As I said to you earlier, there's no surprise ending to this thing. It's there's no chance for a spoiler alert. So I'm wondering what you see when you watch these proceedings. It's kind of this ritual that I find difficult to watch, only because it seems so, in a sense, artificial or a staged drama.
Well, it is hard to watch, and I say that as someone who personally watched, more than 100 nominations hearings, nearly 200 probably since I started working on nominations. Like in person, basically, back between 98 and 2005. And I think it's difficult because a nominee such as this one is skilled at and trained in evasion. And so the conversation is often not very illuminating at all, because the nominee refuses to tell the American people things that she or he has told many people and given speeches about before, or even written about before. And so it's it is very artificial in significant ways, and frustrating, sort of even under the best of circumstances, because of this notion that has become so much more entrenched of a nominee not telling someone how they, quote, would rule on something, and that somehow being a shield against all manner of questions and common sense, as we saw yesterday. But I also think it's challenging because this is a lifetime appointment. If Amy Barrett is confirmed, she could serve to the year 2060 or beyond. She's only 48 years old. And it's hard to believe that this is a sufficient job interview for such a weighty and long-lasting job, given the constraints, as here with this really short timetable, very little time to review her record, very little time for questioning, very little time for written questions, very little time for debate. It's a railroad job, quite frankly, for one of the most important jobs in our country, a job that will outlast Donald Trump no matter what happens this election. And so it's frustrating.
You know, approximately 7,000 attorneys, legal scholars, and sitting and retired judges have signed a letter calling upon the Senate Judiciary Committee to reject Barrett's appointment, citing her ideology, her extreme ideology. What concerns you most about her records, her previous decisions, her opinions? What do you pick up on when you see her record, her track record?
I think I signed that letter.
That's how I learned about it.
Yeah. So it does speak for me. But there are numerous things I think are very concerning about her background and her track record. She that includes the process by which she was chosen for this role, which I would love to talk with you about as we go forward in the conversation. But in terms of her approach, I suppose, you know, one of the things that I think has not received adequate attention is the fact that she was a clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia. And she basically says she'll be a judge in the mold of Antonin Scalia, as well as Larry Silverman, who's one of those most political judges who's ever sat on the D.C. Circuit. And quite frankly, Justice Scalia, despite the homages to him by the right wing and conservatives and even some moderates, the fact is that he wrote his judicial dissents and opinions as if he were writing for the Wall Street Journal editorial board. He managed to miraculously have a judicial philosophy that almost entirely coincided with his personal viewpoint, as could be seen in the speeches he gave to Right to Life groups and others. And only on rare occasions did he actually diverge from those personal views. And of course, he made a big deal out of those rare instances in which he supposedly was constrained to do something that he didn't, to go along with a decision he didn't agree with. You know, it reminds me a little bit of how John McCain, both of them deceased, had a reputation for being a maverick, when I can count on one hand the number of issues in which he was actually a maverick and diverged from voting with the Republicans like 99% of the time. The same with Scalia. He has this reputation, supposedly, of not letting his personal views influence his decisions, when his decisions are larded with advancing his personal agenda on that court. And so for her to say that she's like him, is very much to say that she's going to rule in those ways. And, you know, that includes on cases involving women's reproductive rights. And obviously she's attacked laws that protect women's right to choose, that protect women's reproductive autonomy, and has signed on to statements attacking those legal precedents by asserting her personal view about life beginning its conception, which the right wing has used to attack the Affordable Care Act and its provisions requiring employers to provide health care access for employees. And in the Hobby Lobby case before the United States Supreme Court a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court elevated the supposed religious beliefs of a corporation, the Hobby Lobby Corporation, over the actual rights of individual human beings by blocking them from even having access to IUDs, which are commonplace, ordinary medical devices to prevent pregnancy. But the people who lead Hobby Lobby claimed it that doing so would offend their personal religious beliefs, and so they couldn't be required to provide their staffers with access through just basic health insurance to those common sense devices, because they claim that those are abortificants, which is, you know, an extraordinary claim, quite frankly, scientifically, medically, et cetera. But in that instance, the United States Supreme Court agreed to elevate the supposed conscience of a corporation over the actual rights of individual human beings. And by the way, the Hobby Lobby Corporation was subsequently accused and basically found to have committed theft of artifacts from Israel. So apparently, thou shalt not steal is not one of the, you know, religious tenets that they abide by, but having their female staffers have access to IUDs was a bridge too far. She would, I think, judge in that mold on a host of issues. And that is both on the social issues, but also on corporate rights, on advancing and elevating corporate rights over individuals, which is what the Citizens United decision epitomizes. This idea that corporations have superior rights or First Amendment rights to spend unlimited money, and the CEOs along with them, to spend unlimited money to influence our elections, as long as they don't say the magic words, vote for or against, and then no one gets to know who's spending the money. Meanwhile, Americans in this city, in Madison area, as well as across the country, who are exercising their freedom of dissent, are increasingly constrained from just merely the act of dissenting and standing in protest. So human speech is increasingly criminalized and increasingly repressed, while corporate speech, speech by way of commercials on TV, is elevated. And even this idea of a corporation having a religious belief is elevated over the rights of human beings. And so that's the kind of judge I think she's been chosen, because she represents those views, and that she would act in that way if she were confirmed.
You're listening to Lisa Graves, founder of True North Research and executive director and editor-in-chief of that investigative organization. We're talking, of course, about the ongoing hearings scheduled to end up today regarding Amy Barrett's elevation. Is that the right word? to the Supreme Court.
Well, it's technically correct, because she was confirmed 3 years ago to a seat on the Seventh Circuit, which, by the way, is a seat that Mitch McConnell blocked from being filled by a qualified nominee of President Obama, a woman named Myra Powell, who was the first African American judge to sit on the Indiana Supreme Court. She had an extensive and well-regarded record, and she was blocked from getting a confirmation of the Seventh Circuit. Mitch McConnell held that seat open, and held it open long enough for them to install Amy Coney Barrett into that role as of October of 2017. So she's been a judge for about 3 years, and now is being elevated to the highest court in the land, to the United States Supreme Court, despite the fact that she really, I think, does not have the suitable independence and fairness to be a judge.
You know, I asked, of course, if elevation was the proper word, proper verb, because it has such a religious connotations oftentimes. So let's talk about that. That is, might you give our listeners some sense, perhaps, of how her nomination came about for this position?
Yes. So, there's a new book out by a woman named Carrie Severino, who is part of the Dark Money Network, that another person named Leonard Leo, who we can talk about in a bit, and we'll talk about it, I guess, shortly, helps fund and has helped steer money toward. Anyway, Carrie Severino's book details that Leonard Leo, who was then the Federal Society's vice president — Federal Society is publicly described as a group of conservative lawyers and and law students. It's sort of debating society, although their real power and impact is much beyond that vanilla description. Leonard Leo worked with Don McGahn, who was then the White House counsel for Trump, to start talking about putting Amy Coney Barrett on the shortlist for Trump, the list basically of who he should choose from for the Supreme Court, just as the Senate was confirming Neil Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch is the man who was confirmed to the seat that was open because Justice Scalia died in February of 2016. The Republicans held that seat open for more than 400 days from February of 2016 through April of 2017. There was no rush to confirm Merrick Garland, who was a judge on the DC Circuit, who was nominated by President Obama, who had been a judge for many years and had a demonstrated track record of fairness and independence in setting aside his personal views. Merrick Garland's nomination sat before the Senate for, I think, more than 300 days without even a hearing. After Trump was sworn in as president and Mitch McConnell moved Gorsuch's nomination through the Senate, immediately Don McGahn and Leonard Leo turned to people beyond the list that they had already shared with the public to add to that list. And that included adding four people, one of whom was Amy Barrett, and then ultimately adding Brett Kavanaugh to that list. So the latecomers to that short list were really the top contenders for any vacancies that would arise. Simultaneously, they had Amy Barrett nominated for a circuit court position, an appellate court position on that Seventh Circuit seat I just described. So while she was in the process of becoming a circuit court judge, they were already grooming the process to install her potentially as a Supreme Court justice, and that was in 2017. Leonard Leo, according to Kerry Severino's book, met with Don McGahn a number of times about this and also met for dinner with Donald Trump to talk with him about adding Amy Barrett to the list, why he should do so. Conversations that are not public and not shared with us, why he was so intensively interested in her, as well as Don McGahn. When the following year a nomination, a vacancy arose with Justice Kennedy's retirement, there was a big battle for about a week about whether Trump was going to nominate either Brett Kavanaugh or Amy Barrett. That was the fight. Ultimately, he chose Brett Kavanaugh. Notably, he chose Brett Kavanaugh over the objections of a guy named James Bopp. Sorry for all these names, Alan. I need a chart for it, I suppose. But James Bopp should be notorious in the state of Wisconsin because he is a lawyer from Indiana, by the way, who has litigated cases before the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of Wisconsin Right to Life, attacking Wisconsin's campaign finance laws, Wisconsin's anti-corruption laws. That's his role. And he, in fact, was the initial lawyer and architect of the Citizens United case that ultimately went to the Supreme Court, resulting in the terrible Citizens United decision. And Bopp was urging Mr. Trump that basically Amy Barrett was more of a sure vote, more aligned potentially than Brett Kavanaugh. Anyway, after Kavanaugh was confirmed, it wasn't clear whether there would be another vacancy. But then as soon as Justice Ginsburg passed away this fall, about a month ago, Amy Coney Barrett's name was circulated. And in fact, President Trump had said he was saving Barrett for a vacancy by Ginsburg that he wished for her demise, so that he could put Amy Barrett into that role. And that's what he had said. That's why he didn't choose her for the Kennedy seat, because he was saving her to be a woman to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So that's the tale. And there's definitely more to the story about Leonard Leo and his financial network and more.
I'm glad you came back to Leonard Leo, because I want you to talk a little bit further about the Federalist Society, what its actual functions are as a conduit, as a funder, as a coordinator for this network of foundations and institutes, conservative institutes that do all sorts of things around, court related.
Sure. The lore around the Federalist Society is that it was spontaneously created by a couple of law students in 1981 who were distressed that they were in liberal law schools, and they said that they needed to have a group that advanced their views. They were immediately supported by faculty advisors, which included Antonin Scalia and others who were very active in the right-wing movement, very active in trying to move the law in a very regressive direction. Those students, those three law students, then began hosting events at law schools to talk about basically advancing this, what was known as interpretivism or originalism, or some people call it textualism, this notion that supposedly they were going to just merely follow the law as written and not quote, make the law. When in fact their efforts were directed ultimately, and have been directed ultimately, toward reversing precedents that they don't like. So making the law, or in other words, unmaking the law. Part of the dispute at that time in the early 1980s was an intense opposition by some of the leading thinkers in that originalist movement about Brown v. Board of Education. There's intense hostility to Brown in certainly the southern part of the United States, but obviously also in northern cities as well, at the notion of integration, racial integration in America. And that, in my view, that Supreme Court decision is the most important, one of the most important decisions the court ever issued, because it actually read the actual text of the United States Constitution, equal protection of the law, to bar racial segregation and overturn precedents that had allowed racial segregation. But in essence, you have this reaction in the legal community on the right wing against the decisions of the Warren Court in the 1950s and 1960s that dared to interpret the text of the Constitution to say things like, if you have a right to counsel, oh, you actually have a right to counsel in Gideon v. Wainwright, and other rights of people accused, that you can't be forced to be a witness against yourself. All of these decisions were attacked and assailed, and that was part of that sort of that founding moment, or the zeitgeist at the Federal Society. So that's the origin of it. And in fact, it was almost called the von Mises Society, the Ludwig von Mises Society, to name it after a very far right wing economist who is one of the economists beloved by Charles Koch for his antipathy to the idea of government, having a public function, anything more than protecting property. Ultimately, they decided on the Federal Society. And by 1986, they were a growing movement in the U.S. and in the U.S. law schools. And there were interviews about it in the New York Times. This was around the Bork nomination that was failed to the U.S. Supreme Court. There were interviews in which they basically described their ambition, which was to basically populate all the highest levels of the branches of government. So it's grown to this day, and thank you for this little, letting me give this little tour of it, Alan, but it's grown into a big society of lawyers and law students, and it's funded by Charles Koch and Koch Industries and the Koch family fortune, as well as other big corporations and anonymous donors. And for many years, it has had in its top leadership Leonard Leo, who has been a key leader of the effort to basically capture the United States courts, both the federal courts and courts like the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, to advance a very regressive agenda. And he has gotten quite rich, it appears, doing so.
You're listening to Lisa Graves, investigative journalist, legal scholar, activist. We'll be opening up the phone lines very shortly. I see we have one caller already in queue. We'll be opening up very shortly at 608-256-2001, extension 9. Just one further question about the Federalist Society, of course, and that is the fact that, as you mentioned, Leonard Leo, who was key in this Barrett nomination, it's not only does he head the Federalist Society at this point, Lisa?
He is the co-chair of the board of the Federalist Society. Earlier this year, he stepped back in order to formally, basically officially associate with a for-profit entity that advises donors on where to basically give their money to, in my view, capture the courts.
Right. Because the other thing I picked up on in this recent article you wrote has to do with the fact that he sits on the boards of all these kind of, it's like this interlocking network of funders, foundations, institutes, and so on. We can maybe get back to that a little bit, but since Randy is waiting for us, let's bring him up on the online. Hi, Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, and good afternoon, Ms. Graves. The well, everything reminds me right now of Jack Beatty's statement that Mitch McConnell gives hypocrisy a bad name. But one thing that I was wondering, I believe it was Dick Durbin in his questioning, he said that she doesn't have to worry about politicizing herself because Trump has already done that for her. He's made it clear why he wants her in the position, and elevated, as I believe you said. And I wonder if it's still viable to suggest as the moral question that she simply recuse herself on the big issues that Trump thinks she's supposed to be his dancing monkey on.
Thanks, Randy.
That's an excellent question, Randy, and I think that you're exactly right. And as Durbin said, he has politicized her by his statements about why he chose her. You know, basically his litmus test that he is choosing only people who will overturn the Affordable Care Act, which provides healthcare access for millions of Americans and protects every single American who may have a pre-existing condition, which is many of us and an increasing number in this time of COVID. And he also has said, as you note, or referred to quite expressly, that he said he needs someone on this court in order to rule on cases that he will bring to it about this election to stop ballots from being counted. And he also has said he needs someone to overturn Roe v. Wade. Those are express statements of the president, and they have politicized this nomination. But the election part is perhaps the most damning because it's an effort to of his belief that he can use the Supreme Court, a mere majority of that court, to remain in power no matter what American voters say and how they cast their votes, which is anathema to the idea of being a democracy, to have some sort of judicial fiat. And quite frankly, in my personal view, if Amy Barrett were the moral person that she's portrayed as, she would refuse to either A, participate in this charade of this jamming through her nomination right before an election under the conditions that he is trying to put her on to decide his election. But at a minimum, that she should absolutely, affirmatively, unequivocally commit that she would recuse herself from any cases involving this election. And she has completely failed and refused to do so. I don't think that you can be a person who is devoted to the idea of the court as an independent institution, as an important check and balance in our government, and not agree to recuse under these circumstances. Instead, she said that she would merely follow the rules on recusal, which are very wobbly and weak, and predominantly focus on financial conflicts of interest. It's crystal clear that she should absolutely recuse, and that's why I've called for her recusal through my new project called the Ben Franklin Project, which is demanding that very thing. But the fact is that she has refused that, and I think that both casts a cloud over the United States Supreme Court, which has already been clouded, a much darker cloud over it with this election, and also, quite frankly, it casts a cloud over her character for this job, that she won't make such a commitment.
Lisa Graves, I want to, we got a couple callers waiting, but I wanted to get to continue the story, our storyline here a little bit. Talk about the role of the Bradley Foundation as, again, another one of these coordinating bodies with lots of cash. I was surprised to learn in your article, going through it again this morning, that Bradley outspends the Koch family foundations in funding right-wing conservative initiatives. The Bradley Foundation, of course, many of our listeners might be familiar with because it's, of course, Milwaukee-based. I became familiar with it as the linchpin, the theoretical and financial backer of the moves to privatize public education, voucher schools, and so on. But talk about in this context, this this other body that that they create these fantastic names, innocuous names, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Sure. Well, so the Bradley Foundation was founded in Wisconsin by the Bradley brothers, who were notorious anti-labor, an anti-labor firm in Milwaukee. And their foundation for the past few decades has been led by basically people closely tied to the RNC, to the Republican Party, and to recently the former governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker. And they have increased, that foundation has nearly $1 billion in assets. It's one of the richest foundations in the United States. That's because of some combining of some assets of some heirs of the Bradley brothers. But the Bradley Foundation has gotten a free pass by many of the reporting entities in Wisconsin because it gives money to the symphony and to arts. I call that greed washing. It's certainly nice to have funding for the arts. We need more funding for the arts. We actually need more public funding for the arts, quite frankly, but that's greed washing. The reality of the core work that Bradley does is to advance the right-wing movement in the United States. And it has spent substantial funds to undermine, in my view, public education in America. As you point out, Alan, its efforts in Wisconsin and nationally to advance vouchers that basically limit money for public schools and give tax incentives for private schools, including private religious education and more, as well as other sort of schemes that have been erected by people like Milton Friedman and others to get away from what they call government schools and to limit funding for great universal public education. But in terms of this issue, the Bradley Foundation reached out to Leonard Leo to ask him where they could send money to fund Supreme Court briefs. And they described the Supreme Court amicus briefs. These are friend of court briefs, not by the parties, but by other groups. They said that an amicus brief costs about $250,000 per brief. And in the documents that were made public on the dark web a couple of years ago about the Bradley Foundation, in those documents, in their own language, the Bradley Foundation describes what they're doing as trying to orchestrate these high caliber amicus briefs in order to change the law. In that instance, one of the cases was specifically attacking the Affordable Care Act, and another case was attacking labor rights through a case that was known as Friedrichs and then was subsequently replaced with the case that Americans now know as Janus, the Janus decision. So the Bradley Foundation, this nonprofit foundation, was intimately involved in orchestrating cases that were being brought to the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, it takes credit in those grant documents for funding the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Alan, which you mentioned, which basically orchestrated that case, that attack on the ACA. The Competitive Enterprise Institute is founded by another Koch man, Fred Smith, who was Koch's right-hand man at one of the first organizations he created in the late 1970s. So you also have Koch funding for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and it has spent much of its time in these last 30 years focused on attacking any climate change legislation and environmental rules, but it has suddenly in these recent years gotten involved in fighting the Affordable Care Act. And that's, you know, coincidentally or not, one of the pet attacks of Charles Koch. Charles Koch has spent millions and millions of dollars of his own money, the money of the billionaires that he brings together to advance attacks on the Affordable Care Act since it was a conception back in 2009, a legislative proposal that originated from the Heritage Foundation and Republicans like Mitt Romney, in place of having universal health care, Medicare for all. And Koch has been attacking it relentlessly. He spent money funding the National Federation of Independent Businesses. So here you have the man who helms one of the largest corporations in the world, Koch Industries, one of the biggest companies on the planet, becoming suddenly the secret biggest funder of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which describes itself as the voice of small business, at the time that it was filing litigation before the Supreme Court challenging the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned it's the case that the Bradley Foundation has spent more on these issues than the Koch family foundations. But the unknown factor there is that we know for certain that Koch Industries itself funds some of these operations, including Americans for Prosperity, its group in Wisconsin and nationally that is actively engaged in election related activities to try to get more right wingers in office in Wisconsin and everywhere. So we don't know how much Koch Industries has given, but Bradley Foundation is a formidable amount, represents a formidable amount of money, and it clearly has been playing a behind the scenes role in influencing what cases get to the Supreme Court. And that's not disclosed in those pleadings. It's not described who their funders are. And as Senator Whitehouse pointed out this week, you have a situation where Leonard Leo is helping with the sort of steering these money toward these amicus briefs, and also being the guy who's deciding who the president chooses from, who's on the Supreme Court. So basically choosing the referee for the court, as well as helping to get the cases that he wants the court to hear, a majority of the court to hear. And as he described in a story, he was quoted in a story by the Washington Post last May, by Robert O'Hara and Sean Boberg, he sits at the helm, basically, of a network of $250 million worth of funding to capture the U.S. Supreme Court, federal courts, and the state courts. And before I wrap on that, let me just say, Alan, one of the things that is really shocking to me is that because he's a, quote, volunteer for Trump on this judicial nominations process, he has no financial disclosure forms. There's no indication of where his money is coming from. In 2018, we now have the financial filings that show that the Federalist Society paid him about $100,000 less than his total compensation, which is usually around $500,000, paid him about $100,000 less because he was spending time, quote, volunteering on the Supreme Court nomination. And yet that summer, after Brett Kavanaugh was nominated, Leonard Leo paid off the mortgage of his house in Virginia. And on the eve of the vote to confirm Kavanaugh, the day the cloture vote was taken, basically within 24 to 30 hours of that vote, Leonard Leo closed on a mansion in Maine that sold for $3.3 million. There should be an investigation of that, in my view.
What's money?
Yeah.
we're gonna go, you know, we're already short of time. We have so much we can go into. So we're going to take, there's several calls waiting. I'm going to ask, we have three people in the queue. I'm going to ask people to keep it brief, get your question in so we can get everyone in before the end of the hour. Because, again, there's so much to talk to. Let's start with Will. Hi, Will, you're on the air.
Thanks, Al. Thanks to you and your guests. I think you stole my thunder with the Bradley Foundation and the Koch brothers. We noticed around the same time what was going on. Since Citizens United, the dark money have been coming in. And I'm wondering, and the question is to the guests, what can we do as a people since COVID-19 have people hunkering down now? Is there anything that we can do to shed light on this and to bring change? And if we can't, what she think we could do? And if I feel the left don't get them, COVID-19 will.
Thanks. We're going to go right to our next two callers, get our questions in, and then Lisa can respond. Hello, Thomas, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question, I'll make it simple. It seems to me with her on the Supreme Court, we basically have a fascist dictatorship, which I always assume the Republican Party these last years has been anyhow. So that means any law they don't want passed, or any law they want to that is passed, like the voter rights law, the First Amendment to the Constitution, they'll just overthrow it. And so I'll hang up and thank you for the program.
Thanks. And finally, let's go to Ron to get that last question. Hi, Ron, you're on the air.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for the call. I mean, thanks for the program. My question is two parts. Can the Democrats, if they get back in office, one, limit the terms of Supreme Court justices to 10 years and undermine their majority here. And barring that, if that doesn't work, would packing the court, as FDR once advocated, be an option? And given that the court at that time was trying to undermine the New Deal. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, callers. Lisa.
I'll take them in order, if that's all right.
Sure.
Thank you so much. So, Will, I think that the most important mechanism people have right now is to vote and to insist that our votes be counted. And if our votes are not counted, to stand, you know, safely with our feet, with our voices, you know, with social distancing, to demand that our voices be heard. You know, I can't believe we're in this circumstance in the United States. I feel like we need to have election observers from other countries to protect our elections at this point, with the activities to repress the vote by this administration, as well as by the political campaign of the incumbent. So we're in a precarious point, but the first next step really is to vote your conscience. And I would say vote to in whatever way you think best protects our democracy. And then we have to do some real serious organizing together beyond this moment, beyond this election period, to basically restore our institutions and actually make them better, way better than they were, to make them really fulfill their potential to serve our democracy and serve people. And we have to take that on as a matter of principle, as a matter of moral imperative. The alternative is that our democracy will die, and that people's rights will be further trampled. And so we have a moral obligation, in my view, to keep with this fight and not let any temporary setbacks deter us from defending our rights as a people. And so that's one thing. And then talking in conversation with people about why it matters, what our future means, and how our future could be great if we could shake off this corporate control that has predominated since the Powell memo was issued as a blueprint, and people like Charles Koch took it as a game plan for how to basically grossly distort our democracy. In terms of Thomas's point, I think it's important for people to recognize that this Supreme Court, I think, is a damaged institution. It's one that has been packed by right-wing judges. The Supreme Court has nearly 8,000 cases a year where people ask for it to rule on cases, and it only issues about 80 real opinions a year. So it takes 1% of the cases that come to it. Under the Supreme Court rules, with 9 justices, 4 justices can choose to take a case. They only choose it if they think they're going to win, basically, if they think they have 5 votes to do so. That this is the Citizens United case, the Shelby County case on Voting Rights Act, the case on gerrymandering, the extreme partisan gerrymandering that has distorted democracy in Wisconsin and North Carolina and others, where we have basically a minority party dominating the legislature, even though most of the people in the state represent or have voted for Democrats. Those cases were not a fluke. They weren't a coincidence. They weren't a surprise. They were handpicked by a majority on that court, right-wing majority, in order to move the law in the direction that they want, to the right, to undermine our rights. That's the same case with the Janus decision as well. This court has virtually no mandatory jurisdiction. Everything is discretionary, and they're using their power to roll back our rights. And Leonard Leo confirmed that in a speech he gave to donors last year at the Council on National Policy, the Council on National Policy, CNP, where he told donors that America stands at the precipice, those were his words, of, quote, a revival of what he described as the structural constitution, the likes of which no one in the room had seen in terms of rolling back rights 100 years to precedents before the New Deal. He believes that the judges he's helped choose, he's put before Trump, are going to move the law to basically repeal our rights, a century of modern precedent, and that has to be redressed. Which brings me to the last caller's question, Ron's question, which is what can be done. I do think term limits need to be on the table. I also think it's essential that we unpack the courts. This isn't about packing the courts. This is about unpacking them. They've been, so many people have been put through who have very little experience, have predominantly experience as right wingers, as sort of people who are super partisan or super invested in their personal agendas, who don't have demonstrable records of fairness. Or in the case of Amy Barrett, has been a judge and her rulings are very troubling. The idea that the right to bear arms is an individual right that can't be taken away from a felon, a fraudster, but the right to vote can be taken away because in her view, it's a civic or collective right. So it doesn't have the same weight as the right to bear arms is astonishing and outrageous. The idea that she would issue a decision saying, basically saying that it's okay for a corporation to racially segregate its workforce, that doesn't count as a violation of equal employment law. That's outlandish. You know, to rule in favor of an employer where the N-word was used and say that that doesn't create a hostile environment for workers, racially hostile environment is absurd. She is out of step with America. She is out of step with the law. And in this country, the Republicans have been choosing people who are very far to the right for our court, not because they'll be fair, but the opposite, because they believe they won't be fair, because they believe they will advance the interests of that party and the party's political agenda. And in the case of Trump, his political agenda. And it's noteworthy, and I'll end on this point, that in my lifetime, in the last 52 years, there have been 15 nominations of Republican presidents confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and 4 nominations of Democratic presidents confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. 15-4 in more than 50 years. If the Republicans had not stolen the seat that came open in Obama's last year, and if they weren't in the process of stealing this seat right now, despite that historical imbalance, the court would be 5-4 potentially in the other direction. But it's on the precipice of being 6-3. And there's nothing in the Constitution that requires the court be nine people. It can be any number. I personally think it should be 15. We have plenty of cases for the court to hear, and actually we need more courts at every level. So I think there's lots that we can do together.
No, we're running short of time, but we do want to get this final caller in. Hi, Angela, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to thank you for the program and Lisa for the work that she does. She does the deep research that we all need, makes the connections between things for us, and shares it with the public. And it's really helpful, I think, with my heart sometimes, and she gives me facts to go with it. So, Lisa, I really, really appreciate the work you're doing in the world. Hang in there, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you, caller.
Thank you, Angela. That's that touched my heart, and I appreciate that. I know I fight with the facts. I try to make sure people have the facts, but obviously we need to use those facts to touch people's hearts and to make sure that we know what we're fighting for and know what people who are trying to undermine democracy are doing, and that we join together and that we are unwavering in our determination together to advance the human rights of people in this country and to protect our planet.
You know, Lisa, Angela reminded me that before I forget, why don't you give our listeners a site or a place where they can read this article that you sent to me that we've been discussing this hour, that has been, you know, came out last week, and it's so enlightening as to the powers behind, you know, they say pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Well, there's a whole mess of junk behind that curtain.
Yes. So I asked my colleagues at the Center for Media Democracy, where I'm on the board, to publish it on their site, exposedbycmd.org. But I also publish it on my website, which is truenorthresearch.org. That's my primary website. And truenorthresearch.org. And I was very grateful for my hero, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, in his eloquence in describing his research, the research that he's done. He has a book called Captured, which I think is a must-read book. His comments and the Judiciary Committee were so powerful, so important for the American people to hear. And it was generous of him to also cite my research and the Center for Media Democracy's research is along the lines of the work that he's been doing and his team has been doing as well. So you can find it there. You can also join our effort to call for Amy Barrett to recuse and for Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General, to resign at benfranklinproject.org. Sorry, that's another name to hand out. And I also have a little pet project that I work on with Connor Gibson from Greenpeace called Coke Docs, kochdocs.org, which is where we keep a lot of the original documents and materials about Charles Koch and his empire and his effort to remake America in his own very selfish interests.
Lisa, what's that article we're referring to? It has a lengthy title. We might want to give that so people know what they're looking for, get a sense of what they're looking for.
Oh, can you give it? I can't remember. It has clauses in it. Do you have it before you?
Snapshot of secret funding of amicus briefs tied to Leonard Leo, Federalist Society leader and promoter of Amy Barrett. Again, snapshot of secret funding is the opening to the name of that article. It's a deep and complex article, but well worth a close read. Lisa, we got, say 2-3 minutes left in the hour. Some final thoughts, maybe. Well, maybe we can go back to, I'm fascinated with the ritual of the whole thing. That is, it's like a kabuki dance, a charade. It's a done deal. But the Democrats on this committee, at some level, become complicit in legitimizing this charade.
Well, I think that it's a difficult position in a way for the Democratic senators because the rules have been changed and distorted by Mitch McConnell, and so they don't have a lot of options. I know that there are some who've talked about ways they could derail it, but as a person who's worked in the Senate Judiciary Committee and has looked at rule options, quite frankly, most of the rules are dependent on your opponent wanting to get something else done. And Mitch McConnell doesn't want to do anything besides judges, and this president doesn't really need legislation. He rules sort of by tweet and fiat. And so I think that it would be a shame for the Democrats to walk away and cede that territory to the disinformation of the Republican members of that committee. And I was grateful that they focused on the Affordable Care Act predominantly and not trying to deal with her evasive answers. She was just going to evade.
Well, again, I want to thank you ever so much. It's always an informative hour to have you on. And I wish we could talk for, the rest of the afternoon. Lisa Graves, I want to thank you very much. I want to thank Rochelle for her marvelous job task helping me through this hour and learning all this technology as I sit here at my table at home. I want to thank our callers, you, our listeners. Last week I announced that we're going to have on, supposedly set for this week, Ramsey Kanaan from PM Press, but he had some medical business he had to take care of, so he's scheduled for next week. Again, I want to thank you all. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I will be speaking with you next week.